Judge Hamilton and I are pleased and, of course, privileged to have sitting with us this morning Judge Feinerman of the Northern District of Illinois, and we welcome him to the bench this morning. All right, our first case for argument this morning is Phillips v. Prudential Insurance. Mr. Parry?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Ron Parry. I represent the appellant in this case. My co-counsel is Robert Cummins from here in Chicago. This is an appeal from the Southern District of Illinois. The court there determined that our complaint failed to state a cause of action and dismissed the complaint. This lawsuit arises out of a retained asset account, Prudential Life Insurance Company's retained asset account. I'd like to spend just a few minutes talking about retained asset accounts in the life insurance industry. The way a life insurance company works, basically, is they collect premiums, and they have to take part of the premiums and set those aside to use to pay death benefits. The remainder of the premium goes into what's called the general investment account, and they have highly skilled investment professionals that invest that money, and big insurance companies like Prudential usually have billions, in fact, tens of billions of dollars in their general investment account. In the 1980s, people in the life insurance industry determined that they could retain funds in their general investment account for a longer period of time by delaying the payment of death benefits. So whereas they normally would send out a check to pay a death benefit, they developed the retained asset accounts in the 1980s in a program that was called checkbook instead of a check. They would send out a checkbook, or actually a book of drafts, rather than sending a check. That would delay the payment of the death benefit, and in some cases people would leave their death benefit to be invested in the general investment account for months or even years after the death benefit was due and payable. Now, these investment professionals that invest money in the general investment account generally are able to earn returns of 5, 6, 7% a year, maybe even better than that in good economic times. But they pay a money market rate of interest for the use of the money that they're investing in the general investment account. So that's basically what our lawsuit's about. We don't say that there's anything inherently evil or inherently illegal about retained asset accounts. And in fact, most states have statutes that allow retained investment accounts, retained asset accounts, to be operated. What we say, however, are two things. Number one, you can't operate a retained asset account like Prudential's Alliance account without full disclosure, making full disclosure about where the money's going to be invested, how much they're going to charge, how much they're going to make on it, and the types of investments in which it's invested. The second thing we say is you can't do that unless the policy owner or the death beneficiary have agreed to it, have agreed to allow their money to remain in that retained asset account.
Now, do we have that an option exercise in this case, Mr. Parry?
Well, that's what I want to get into now. We have to kind of walk through the policy and then the claim documents to determine exactly whether or not this was agreed to. If you read the policy, it says, and I can't quote it exactly, but in summary it says that we will pay the death benefit promptly. It can be paid in a single sum, or you may select a settlement option in the policy. There are five settlement options in the policy. These types of settlement options have been around for decades, perhaps centuries, long before retained asset accounts. None of the settlement options in this policy are the Alliance account. So what the policyholder had is a requirement of payment promptly in a single sum, but if they wanted to exercise one of the five settlement options, they had to make a written request to the company.
I mean, that's your gloss on this, so let's quote it. You may choose, this is to the,
yes,
the insured person, you may choose to have any death benefit paid in a single sum or under an optional mode of settlement. Why does that make any one particular form the default?
Because to get an optional mode of settlement, you must send in a request.
It says you may choose applying to all of those.
Right, but there's another section of the policy that says that if you want to receive an optional mode of settlement, you must send in a request.
Where's that?
This is cited on page 5 of our opening brief. It's Appendix 71.
Mm-hmm, I'm there.
On request, details of the options we describe below or any others we may have available at the time proceeds become payable.
Right. So I'm looking for language that says single sum is the default. Or that clearly
there is no language
it.
That says precisely
that. Or
that
clearly
that.
Implies it.
Your Honor, I would submit that this implies that in the absence of a request that the payment should be.
The request is for information.
About the settlement options.
It looks to me like they don't have to pay anything until a choice is exercised.
So, well, I would submit that in absence of a request, the requirement is single sum. I mean,
I know that's your position, but based on what language in the policy?
Well, let me move on to something else about the policy and the alliance account. The alliance account is not mentioned at all in the policy. It's not one of the settlement options.
I know that. We're going to talk to the Prudential lawyers about that. But I'm asking, but would you agree that there is no language in the policy that makes the single sum payment the default?
There is no language that says that, but as I've indicated, I believe that that's a fair reading of this, is in the absence of a request for a settlement option, that the single sum payment is.
I understand required. Your position.
Mm-hmm. Now, then we move to the period at or past the time of death when the claim form comes out, and the person, the death beneficiary, indicates that they want to make a claim for a death benefit. The claim form comes out. And what it says is that the alliance account, which again is not at all mentioned in the policy, it says that the alliance account is the preferred method of paying. It says there are other settlement options that are available, and those are the five that were in the policy. So what has disappeared by the time the claim form comes out is the ability to receive payment in a single sum. That is not an option. The alliance account has become the default option. The five other options that were in the policy, which does not include the alliance account, are the other options. So you have, if you read the policy, you have a single sum and five options. You could get one of those. If you read the claim form, you could get the five options that you had in the policy, and the default option is the alliance account. So the bottom line is, by the time the claim form comes out, the ability to receive a single sum payment is gone. It's totally gone. We say that that breaches terms of the policy.
How long was it before Ms. Phillips used a draft for the whole amount in the account that had been set up?
It was a matter of months. I don't recall exactly, but it was a matter of months.
Can you tell us how she was hurt?
Well, she was hurt because Illinois law says that she was hurt. Illinois law provides for an interest rate of 9% in the event of a delayed payment of a life insurance benefit. So our view is that she is entitled to recover the delayed interest rate that's provided for by statute.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask you about the bulletin that you rely upon?
Yes,
to tell us that Illinois law is in your favor. In the appendix copy, there's no indication that that bulletin did not take effect until July of 2011. And that seems to me like something that you should have told us.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe it did take effect because the
And return. Why are you telling us that that is controlling Illinois law for your claims of your clients without alerting us to the effective date issue?
Because I believe that that interprets the statutes.
Don't you think that's something when the Illinois Department of Insurance orders beginning July 1, 2011, doesn't that seem to at least imply that it was not required before And don't you think that's the kind of issue you should have alerted us to when you cited it to us?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I agree with you.
I'll take that as an apology.
Yes, sir. I do apologize. Now, we also asserted a claim for breach of fiduciary duty. We believe that the law is that when one undertakes to invest another's money and has full discretion to determine how the money is invested, that full disclosure is required. We cite some stockbroker cases, and that would be a good analogy in my view. When you go to a stockbroker to open an account...
Well, if I deposit my money in a bank, and this is kind of like a shadow bank, basically, shadow banking account or mutual fund account, but if I deposit my money in a bank with a promise to pay me, today it would be about 0.01% interest, but in the good old days, maybe 5% interest, they don't have to tell me how they invest the money, do they?
No, they don't.
I expect them to make a spread.
And that's the analogy that Prudential makes, is that this should be treated like a bank account. And the theory behind bank accounts is that when one makes a deposit in the bank becomes the owner of those funds. The depositor is merely a creditor of the bank. It's a debtor-creditor relationship, and that's what they're arguing. This is not fiduciary, it's debtor-creditor. Well, I don't think that applies in an insurance situation like this, where the company is electing to retain the funds rather than the person, whether in your example...
That depends on your choice, on whether you're right about the exercise of the option, right?
Right. But if it's a debtor-creditor relationship, then that means the death benefit's not yet been paid. If they still owe the death benefit, then the death benefit's not been paid. And that's what they argue. It's not fiduciary. It's debtor-creditor. So my time for this part is expired, and I'll reserve some time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Mr. Eisenman?
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Eisenman for the appellees, Pruco Life Insurance Company and Prudential Insurance Company of America. I want to turn first to some of the questions that Judge Hamilton raised with opposing counsel. The alliance account, I think one of the questions was, how does one choose the alliance account? And opposing counsel said it wasn't listed in the contract. And there's two reasons why that's not true. The first one is the contract specifically says that the beneficiary can choose another settlement option other than the ones available. That's on page 71 of the appendix. The second reason is that when it lists the settlement options, it lists option three, which is interest payment. Under option three, the insurance company holds onto the money, pays you interest, and it says pays a minimum interest of 1.5%. This is just option three, except you get a checking account. I'm sorry. This is just option three, but you get a checkbook to access the funds. Other than that, if she was earning 3%, that's more than the 1.5% minimum. So you both have option three that already appears here. You don't have to use the checkbook if you don't want to.
Then in addition, why not tell the beneficiary in the option form that she can just have a check?
Well, Your Honor, the option form, you're referring to the claim form?
Claim form, yes.
Right. Well, the claim form doesn't list any of the options. The claim form is what you submit to get your claim, and what it says is if you don't choose something else, you will get an alliance account, and it describes it. But then it says if you want a settlement option, there is a you can list it below. And then there's a blank there, and she leaves a blank. Then below that, it says, if you want a payment option under the contract, then list that below. And that's where you write single sum, because that's one of the choices you have under the contract.
So why not just remind the beneficiary, who may never have seen the policy, what those options are?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the claim in this case is breach of contract.
Why not do that as the decent way to do business? Is this the way Prudential wants to treat its customers and the people who have been counting on it for their security?
Well, Your Honor, a couple things. Number one, in order to submit the claim form, typically you send in the policy with it. It specifically references the policy, and it gives you an 800 number if you have any questions.
This is pretty. It's pretty clear what's going on here, right? The insurance industry decided some years ago to try to shift in the way it did business, and to try to, at least we are entitled to assume this on a 12B6 motion, right? That the insurance industry decided to shift the way it does business, and to try to retain control of assets as long as possible, and basically set up these kind of shadow bank accounts that are not insured by the FDIC, or shadow mutual fund accounts that are not held by independent trustees and are not subject to the kinds of protective regulations that those are subject to, right? Is that a fair description?
Not entirely, Your Honor.
Okay, what's wrong with that?
Number one, when you say it was a way to retain assets, that part is accurate. However, first of all, you see it's not insured by the FDIC. At the time that this claim, that the events occurred, FDIC insurance covered $100,000. This was covered by a state guarantee association up to $300,000. So the money was protected.
None of that was actually explained in any detail to somebody making the choice, though, right?
If you're making
the choice now, you've got the choice between one state's guarantee fund and the full faith and credit of the United States government, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, Your Honor, it's disclosed six or seven times that it's not FDIC insured.
Far enough down at the bottom, it was actually cut off in the appendix in a few places. So,
we didn't prepare the appendix, Your Honor, but
that's how close to the edge and how small the print is, right?
It's disclosed repeatedly. It's in small lettering. Your Honor, the important point, though, is that if you get a check, until you cash it, you don't have the money. This gave you access to the money just as quickly. You get a checkbook, you can write it out. The court asked how long it took her to take the money out. That's not alleged in the complaint. There's a pretty good reason why it's not alleged in the complaint. It took her 20 days to take the money out. When they say that there's been a delay, they never allege how long the delay is, and there's a good reason why they don't allege how long it is. Judge Hamilton, I think you hit the big issue on breach of contract. The language in the contract says you may choose to have a death benefit paid in a single sum or under an optional mode of settlement. It's not creating a preference for one over the other. So she was provided the opportunity to make that choice. She signed a piece of paper under oath choosing something, and then if she didn't like it, she could take the money out immediately.
Counsel, can I bring you back to something you mentioned at the beginning? You suggested, at least to my ears, that settlement option number 3 was the Alliance account. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. Well, sort of. An Alliance account gives you everything that settlement option number 3 gives you, plus it gives you a checkbook to access the funds. But it gives you money being held at interest at a minimum interest rate. The minimum guaranteed is 1.5%. She actually got 3%. So she was getting twice what the minimum that she was guaranteed to get. It's functionally the same, but it gives you something a little more, which is the checkbook to access the funds.
Okay. What did Ms. Phillips get along with the claims form? She got the claims form and the settlement brochure, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And did the settlement brochure list the lump sum option?
It did not, Your Honor. And the reason is that the settlement brochure is listing settlement options. Under the contract, you had a choice between a payment option, single sum payment. That's already listed there in the contract. And then you have the settlement options, which may be the same or different from what's listed in the contract.
So was Ms. Phillips sent a copy of the insurance policy or the insurance contract along with the claims form?
It's the other way around, Your Honor. She sent in the insurance policy with the claims form. And I should mention that the settlement brochure is not before the court. It's not part of the record. It was not attached to the complaint, unlike the claims form and unlike the contract, which is part of the record here.
So you're saying that when she filled out the claims form, she necessarily had a copy of the insurance policy, which in turn referenced the lump sum option?
Your Honor, again, it's not part of the record. The claim form does reflect the fact that the policy is being sent in. Whether or not she personally did that or not isn't within the record, but it does. Unless you have the policy, I'm not sure how you know that you can be filing a claim.
Well, I suppose you could know that you're a beneficiary under an insurance policy, contact the insurance company, get a claims form without ever coming in contact with the policy itself.
So I think that's right, Your Honor. However, here, as I say, the claim form reflects that the policy was sent in. In addition, there's an 800 number you can call if you have any questions. You can call the agent. And in any case, let's say what you really wanted after all this was a check. So you get this checkbook instead. You immediately write yourself out a check for the full amount. You deposit it. You get your money just as quickly. So it's not as if if somebody was really confused, they're still not going to be in any worse position. They're actually in a better position because during that interim period until they cash that check, they're earning interest on it. They're earning 3% interest, which is a lot higher than what you'd be earning in a bank. Whereas if a check got issued to you, the second the check gets cut, you don't earn any more interest, no matter whether it takes you a day or a month or however long it takes you to deposit that check. For the breach of fiduciary duty claim, I want to say very briefly, as they concede, there is no fiduciary duty that arises under an insurance policy. That when they analogize to an investment broker, the problem here is that she was promised that she would get all of her principal back plus interest. She had no investment risk. So the idea of, well, you should have disclosed where you put the money, you should have disclosed what you invested it in, it's not relevant to her. The only thing that's relevant to her is that she gets her money back and she gets interest. And there's no contention that she did not get exactly that.
The risk with these things is the solvency of the insurance company, right?
Technically, that would be true. Of course, in this case, Your Honor.
Well, technically, let's think of 2008, where some pretty big organizations suddenly became very shaky about their ability to meet their obligations, right?
Your Honor, Prudential most certainly did not become insolvent. If it had, we'd have a very different case here.
Prudential is not the only company that's doing these kinds of retained asset accounts, though.
No, it's the standard in the industry, Your Honor. Virtually every major insurance company uses this as a settlement option. But, Your Honor, my answer is that she did not lose any money.
Uses it as a default settlement option?
Practices vary. In 2008, when this occurred, that was much more common.
What is it now?
It's the industry is in a state of flux right now, Your Honor, so it varies by state. And it also depends on the terms of the policy. In Illinois, it's still the default.
Have other regulators taken the kinds of steps that Illinois took in 2011 to try to insist on more complete disclosure?
Some regulators have. The NAIC, which is it's the organization of insurance regulators, also issued a draft, like a proposed regulation that is similar in many ways to the Illinois Bulletin. And again, that draft type of regulation wasn't issued until after the events in this complaint.
Okay, and you've got 50 plus regulators who need to decide what to do.
Right, and a number have looked at it and said we're fine with this. Some have issued additional regulations, but by and large, and that's the situation right now. For the breach of fiduciary duty, the other thing I want to stress is that I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't complete my thought on the fact that an insurance company could become insolvent. She doesn't allege that anybody became insolvent. She doesn't allege she didn't get all of her money plus interest. And so to say after the fact, gosh, in the very unlikely event someone had become insolvent and the State Guarantee Association hadn't covered it, I might have been out of money. That's not an injury. It's that's not when you actually got your money. The other thing is that under Illinois law, you must allege that there is an injury that was proximately caused by the breach. The breach here is nondisclosure. There's nothing in the complaint that suggests that had these things been disclosed, then she would be in somehow be in a better position such that she suffered an injury by not having these things disclosed. She got all of her money plus the interest.
Counsel, can I bring you back to the contract issue? Assume that in the 12B6 context, we have to assume that when Ms. Phillips sent in her claims form, she did not have a copy of the actual insurance policy. So she didn't have any piece of paper in front of her at that point giving lump sum, specifically or expressly identifying lump sum as an option. Now, maybe you're going to question the assumption, and you could do that, but assuming that I'm right in the 12B6 context, would you still argue that there's no breach of contract?
I would, Your Honor. The reason is, first of all, the complaint does not allege what you just said. It doesn't allege she didn't have the policy.
It doesn't allege that she did have the policy.
Well, that's right, Your Honor, but you need to create, under Iqbal, you have to have enough allegations for there to be a plausible claim. And here, what the contract says is you have to give them this choice. She was given that choice. But
she was given a choice, but one of the options, the one that she says she would have taken, isn't mentioned in the claims form, and it isn't mentioned in the settlement brochure. It is mentioned in the policy, but I'm assuming for the moment that she didn't have the policy. So she's basically being given an empty option.
Well, two things. One, Your Honor, there's an 800 number if she didn't have it. Since the claim form says if you'd like a payment option from the policy indicated here, here's an 800 number if you have any questions, she could have called. Secondly, if she didn't like getting a checkbook, she could immediately write herself a check. She gets the money just as quickly. And as I said, she's actually in a better position because she's earning interest in the interim. Finally, she never actually alleges that had she gotten a check, she would be in a better position than what she got. Without an allegation that she'd be in a better position, some plausible explanation of why that would be the case, there's no injury, there's no damage. That's another element of breach of contract under Illinois law. There must be an injury proximately caused. Had she gotten a check, she would be in the same position she was in, except that she would have stopped earning the 3% interest when the check was issued. Your Honor, my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenman. Mr. Perry?
The district court believed, made in effect a finding of fact, that option three was the alliance account. That's the interest-only settlement option. It's not the alliance account. Had we been given an opportunity to offer proof in the case, we would prove that the interest-only settlement option has been around for more than 50 years. It's an option that's been in all policies for a long time. You can just elect to leave your money with the company. The difference between the interest-only settlement option is it's got a guaranteed minimum rate of interest. The alliance account did not have a guaranteed minimum rate of interest. Now, he's correct. She did get 3%, but that could have been dropped to 0.5%.
Just on that point, Mr. Barrett, you want to respond, if you would, to the final comments by Mr. Eisenman on injury in this case?
Yes, the injury, I think, is set forth by Illinois law. It's the 9% that gets paid on delayed settlement in claims. If payment was not made in this case, if...
That's if. Well, but what happened here?
What happened is, I mean, it's pretty clear what happened, is that she got the book of drafts. She held the money in it for approximately a month, and then she wrote a check and got her money out, and she got 3%.
First day, right?
She could have done that the first day, yeah. And there would have been a time for processing and so forth.
I appreciate that.
But this was a point that was made. What they've really done here is set up what is, in effect, an unregulated money market account. If you go to Fidelity or Vanguard today and open a money market account, number one, you're going to get disclosure about their types of investments. You're going to get disclosure about how much they're going to make, which is a tiny fraction on a true money market account. And they're going to be regulated by law as to the types of investments that they can put the money in. You can't invest in office buildings and real estate mortgages and derivatives and things like the investment professionals at Prudential put the money in that's in their general investment account. So what they've really done here is created a situation where they can pay a money market rate of interest, but not be limited to short-term government and corporate paper like true money market accounts are.
Are you focusing primarily on a lack of notice, or are you calling for a change where the insurance industry has to, following these programs, announce where its investments lie?
I think that disclosure, if you're going to put a death beneficiary's money in your general investment account, I think a general disclosure of the types of things that a general investment account invests in is appropriate. And it's not money market investments. It's office buildings, skyscrapers, and other things, as I said. My time's up, and thank you, and I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the